Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Two Dudes Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Hey, Tommy, before we get started right quick, I need you to sign this document here, just real quick. Don't even read it, just sign it.
I hang around with a lawyer part-time, and he tells me never sign anything without reading it. So you're not getting me on that one, Buster. What are you, one of those Nigerian princes, and you want me to sign over for all the money you're going to send me? You're just sitting on?
That's right. I really didn't have anything for you to sign. I wasn't trying to pull a fast one on you.
You were just trying to set me up there, weren't you?
Yeah, I really want your
car. You were trying to set up an intro, I'll bet.
I want your car.
You want my car?
Yeah, I was like, you're going to convey your car to me with that signature.
Oh, well, I thought you wanted something further from me.
Well, we've talked about on the show before, it's very important that you read everything before you sign it.
Absolutely. The four corners.
That's right. You want to read all the four corners. And I've said this before, I think, on this show, is I actually take a lot of pride whenever I'm trying to sign some sort of contract or release, and the person who's working there is trying to hurry me through it and trying to tell me exactly what it says. And I'm like, no, I'm just going to go ahead and read it. It's even better if there's a line forming behind me.
I didn't go to lawyer school all them years for you to tell me what this here paper says.
And we talked about the South Park episode before, the human centipede.
Yes.
Which was pretty good episode if you like South Park.
It was probably better than the movie.
I did not watch the movie.
It was gross.
But that episode talked about where it's important to read the Apple and the iPhone terms of services before you sign it.
Yeah, and did you see the size of it when they brought that out at Mark Zuckerberg's congressional hearing?
Oh, yeah. That was part of the whole smirk.
It was like 6 inches thick. They printed it out. Now, who other than a bunch of old congressmen would print something like that out? But they printed it out, and it was 6 inches thick of paper. It was unbelievable. Has anybody ever read that, do you think? He said, probably not. But he didn't apologize for anything that was in it.
Well, DNA testing for your personal use has become very popular recently. And those, whenever you agree to do that, you actually pay them to do it. And also you sign a pretty lengthy document to do it. And I bet most people don't actually read it and know what they're doing.
Yeah, I would say they probably don't. They just sign it and they're going to find out that they thought they were Irish and they're really German or something. That's the way all the commercials go anyway.
Pretty much.
I used to wear a kilt, and now I'm going to wear a lederhosen. Or not. I think it's the other way around is the way he does it. We've worn lederhosen, now we got to wear a kilt.
Oh, is that what they actually say?
Yeah.
Oh, that's pretty.
That's what they said. We pronounced our family being German all these years, and I even had my own lederhosen. Then after 23andMe or Ancestry.com, whatever it was, find out that we're of Irish descent. So I traded in my lederhosen for a kilt.
I haven't seen that commercial, but I like it.
Yeah.
Especially the fact that you get to say lederhosen.
Lederhosen.
So this whole DNA testing thing kind of took a really
12
interesting...
12 beers, hoser.
12 beers. Up your nose with a rubber hose. Was that McKenzie Brothers too?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I thought so. Strange Brew was one of my favorite movies of all time when I was younger.
Back to the Cheech and Chong type days.
Yeah. Well, I was like, I don't know, 10 or 12. Those are my Cheech and Chong days. Not literally Cheech and Chong days, like, you know, smoking the doobies Cheech and Chong days.
Right.
Just got to throw that out there.
I got you.
Okay. So the DNA testing took an interesting turn recently. And so this episode, we're going to be talking about some violent crimes, specifically some rape and murder. not really the focus of this episode, but just kind of we're touching on it. So if that stuff kind of bothers you, maybe, you know, just be wary of it.
Trigger words.
Trigger words. There you go. So the story that's in the news recently is the Golden State Killer was recently arrested. His name, Joseph, well, he hasn't been proven yet, but we're pretty sure it's him.
DNA says it's
him. DNA says it's him. Joseph James DeAngelo.
This was a cold case that had gone unsolved for a long time.
Yeah, detectives had searched for about 4 decades for any clues that could help them possibly figure out who was the Golden State Killer. He basically terrorized California with a series of rapes and murders in the 70s and 80s. So I didn't really know about this.
No, I've heard of a lot of serial killers in California, but he wasn't one I'd heard of either.
Yeah, it's probably because it took place a little bit too long ago before we really paid attention to that kind of thing in the media. And plus, I think the Zodiac Killer took all the press.
You think?
Maybe. So the Golden State Killer, he was a very clever criminal, and he was known to be very sadistic. He actually taunted authorities and kept staying one step ahead of the police, where they believe he killed 12 people and raped more than 50 and committed 100 burglaries between 1974 and 1986. And then at that point in 86, they just stopped. So pretty prolific criminal.
I want to know what made him stop all of a sudden.
Well, they think maybe he got too old. He couldn't physically keep up with the demanding...
Murdering people's hard work.
Yeah.
You got to be in top physical shape.
Well, basically, he was prowling or committing these crimes in a large area. His mayhem was in 10 different counties, and he was called by different names. The East Area Rapist, the Original Night Stalker, the Diamond Knot Killer, the Visalia Ransacker. And then basically, the authorities kind of came to realize, like, wait a second, this is all one guy. One of the former detectives, a lady named Carol Daly, she was the first to kind of investigate in Sacramento. She said that he was probably the most heinous rapist she had ever seen and that his attacks were bizarre, cruel, and long-lasting. And part of the reason why I said that maybe he got a little bit too old for it is that his attacks were very cunning, the police always said, and they were planned meticulously, that he would watch his victims, broke into their homes, and even called them to try to help learn their routines before striking. And they always seemed to have some sort of escape route via a stream, trail, or field. So it was a very physically demanding type way that he executed these crimes. So probably as he got older, you know, he just couldn't keep up with it, was one of the thoughts, at least now that they know who it is. One of the most chilling stories that I read about it was that there was a forum on the rapes in 1977, and Carol Daly, the detective I mentioned a second ago, said a man rose and said he doubted the rapist would be able to rape a woman in front of her husband since the man would be home and would retaliate. And several months later, that man's wife was raped while he was at home.
Mm. So had that been in the news?
No. Daly said that she says she can't positively say, but she really thinks that he was there at the meeting that night.
Oh, was this like a town meeting?
Yeah, it was like a town
hall. Concerned citizens,
yes,
meeting?
Yes, a forum or town hall. And somebody
said, there's a lot of them that are like that. They want to admire their work, and they save the clippings from the newspaper, and they attend searching for the body. Some of them go and search for the body when they're put out, you know, missing persons, yeah, and stuff like that. They participate in those things because they get some kind of sick pleasure out of it.
Now, they had done a lot of intense searches and everything for this guy, but they were never able to find him and always seemed to be one step ahead. And the thing was, at that time, DeAngelo was a police officer in a small Northern California town of Auburn during that time.
So who would even suspect him, huh?
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, that's not what you're looking for.
A couple of the crimes, like,
we expect a little bit more out of our police officers than raping and killing and torturing.
Yeah, generally speaking.
You know, they have a code of conduct, and I believe that violates it.
Yeah, unless it's some sort of like a Clint Eastwood Magnum Force type thing where they have a code of conduct where they want to kill people because they think they're violating the law.
Well, but that's only if you're Clint Eastwood.
That's true.
And he doesn't torture people. He only does it to people that deserve it. He's just like Dexter. He only killed the bad ones.
As I said, in 1986, the crimes, they pretty much stopped, and the authorities think that basically that maybe he was a little bit too old at that point.
I think he maybe took an anger management class, or maybe he found religion, or maybe he got a good job, so he was too busy with his job.
Yeah.
Maybe if he ever admits to it, then we can find out the real reason.
Yeah, I doubt he's ever going to admit to it.
Well, he's got nothing to lose. He's like 72, and if they put him on death row or whatever, he's not going anywhere.
Yeah, but this trial will take a long time, I'm sure. Unless he pleads out to it right away.
Well, I hope he tells what happened so we know.
Well, it'd be good for the victims to know these things. I mean, that's kind of gives them peace. So, and I said that he went by these different names, and in 2001, actual DNA evidence linked that the East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker were the same person. So DNA kind of pieced together that, hey, this was all the same person. So,
I'm going to tell you, this is part of the problem. These monikers, they hang on them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes it sound cool. It glamorizes it. Now, I don't know whether it's the media or the policeman, but it's like the Zodiac Killer, the East Area Strangler, the original Night Stalker coming at you. You know, if they called you the Toilet Licker, you probably wouldn't want to do anything again, because then they'd be writing about you in the paper as the Toilet Licker or something. But when they give you a cool name, that just motivates you. They need to quit giving these guys cool names.
The Degenerate Toilet Licker has struck again.
Yeah, who wants to be called that? He'd say, well, I'm going to straighten up. The heck with this. They're going to call me those kind of names. Nobody wants to be known as that.
Now, Paul Holes, and this is a story about how this came to be. Paul Holes. Yes.
Is that H-O-L-E-S?
H-O-L-E-S.
Paul Holes? That's got to be an alias.
No. Maybe not. I don't know. He was an investigator for the Contra Costa County District Attorney's Office and had been tracking the Golden State Killer for 24 years. He was getting ready to retire, and he really wanted to crack this case and figure out who it was. It kind of became one of his pet project to figure out who this was. He came across the file in the mid-90s when he was a forensic scientist, and he had handled some other serial predator cases, but this was the one that really stood out because of all the efforts they put towards it and just the sheer brutality of all the crimes that were committed. And he says that he was struck by the lengths this predator would go to instill fear in his victims. It was psychological terror. A detective told him in 2002, in which a young kidnapping victim was identified using her DNA in a genealogy website, and he thought to himself, I wonder if I could possibly use one of these DNA websites to help track down the Golden State Killer. Because that had been done, I guess, back in 2002 was maybe the first time it had been done. So he started researching this idea and came upon this website called GED Match, which is a kind of like a tool, and it's really a website that doesn't have a lot of frills, and you're basically allowed to upload genetic information and search a database of roughly a million people for possible family connections. So it's almost more like, it's not really a testing service, it's more like a database of different DNA that's been submitted. He partnered with an FBI lawyer, and they found a evidence kit from a rape and murder of Charlene and Lyman Smith, and had been kept in a freezer since 1980. I guess the DNA samples over the years had been kind of depleted as they tried to test these things, and they actually, that was kind of a concerning thing. They were running out of samples.
They don't always store them properly, and they can
decay
in that manner.
Yeah, exactly, because things, technology's changed a little bit too, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit more later. But so they were able to get an actual DNA sample from a case, and they converted that sample into a format that you could put into the GED match. They waited to see what would pop up. And Holes really thought that this was going to be just another dead end and nothing would come of it. But it was not a close match, but they found 10 to 20 distant relatives of the killer. So basically these were kind of like third cousins.
Right.
So it wasn't like an exact match, but it was enough to like say, hey, these people are probably related to this guy.
He came out of this cluster.
Yeah.
So, cluster of humans is somehow related to it.
Now here's where it gets really amazing. They took that information and they traced the lineages of these cousins far enough back into like the early 1800s. So they basically found out who the great-great-grandparents were. So they traced it backwards first. And then basically what they did is they began to trace the offspring and building it forward to try to find potential suspects. So
they had to find somebody that was in the right age range during that date that would be related to them and lived in that general area.
Pretty much, yeah. They had they used census data, old newspaper clippings, gravesite locators, and then they actually went to police databases and used websites like LexisNexis, like lawyers use a lot, to do people searches and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they also used Ancestry.com, the website, and they would actually, there's a group of people in the police force working on this, and they would use their weekends and while they were in meetings and whatnot, they would sit there and kind of go through this. It's kind of like, on the back burner. They kept working on it when they had some extra time here and there and really really worked on it. So they've got it down to a couple of people, and then they were able to use an old police tactic to identify this guy.
They brought him in and beat him with a rubber hose?
Close. We're going to get to it. After some pending motions, I believe.
Well, yes, if it please your honor, we would like to approach the bench to pay for court costs.
All right, well, who do we have on the docket today?
We have on the docket our fine friends at DollarShaveClub.com.
If you ever shower or brush your teeth or try to make your hair look presentable...
I've done that before.
A time or two. We've got some good news for you. Dollar Shave Club has a lot of stuff to help you out.
Well, I think you know by now that Mike and I are big fans of DollarShaveClub.com.
If you don't know that, then you have not been listening to our podcast because we talk about it all the time.
So please listen. Of course, if you're not listening, you won't hear this plea, so that will be not good for us or Dollar Shave Club.
And let me just go ahead and state something here really quickly. This is a podcast, so you can't see us. We are meticulously groomed individuals.
Head to toe.
Head to toe. And everything in between. I'm just going to throw that out there.
That's right. Just in case you're thinking about one wipe Charlie's.
Dollar Shave Club can deliver everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best.
Dollar Shave Club has everything you need to get ready in the bathroom. Much more than just razors.
But the razors are pretty awesome.
They are. I highly recommend them.
Dollar Shave Club, yes, that Dollar Shave Club, delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it. Shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even a wipe that'll leave your tush feeling tingly clean.
Ooh, I feel so tingly down there. I'm a big...
I've been here with Mrs. Doubtfire.
I'm a big fan of their Amber and Lavender Calming Body Cleanser. It calms my body like nothing else. Never smelled anything like it, in a good way. Good luck finding a product that great at the store.
And all of Dollar Shave Club's products are made with top-shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. You'll feel the difference. Plus, shipping is free with your membership.
And here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essential Starter Set. It comes with body cleanser, one wipe Charlie's, their amazing butt wipes.
They're tingly.
They're very tingly down there. Their world famous shave butter and their best razor, the 6-Blade Executive.
Keep those blades coming for just a few more bucks a month. And add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need.
Check it all out at DollarShaveClub.com/court.
That's DollarShaveClub.com/court.
And please, tell them Mike and Tommy sent you.
So, I had that tingly teaser before we had our ad there.
Woo!
So, I said they used an age-old trick to catch old D'Angelo.
Oh, yeah? What is it?
Well, they put him under surveillance. And they picked up his trash from the side of his curb.
Oh, the old public trash routine.
Yep, and they found some items that had his DNA.
Like Q-tips or cups or butt wipes.
You think they found a one-wipe Charlie at his house that had
you
some...
You never know.
I'd hate to be the guy who got that one. It's like, I think we got him. We got him brown-handed.
Hard to put your finger on it.
So, after they were able to
he fell through the cracks.
After they were able to pin it on him, they arrested him.
Can't you guys turn the other cheek?
And now he faces 8 counts of murder. So
8 counts of murder.
Yeah, but think about that. How all the work that went into catching this guy and the odds that it would happen like that. I mean, they had to do a lot of work. They had to find possible relatives. They had to trace it back to find a common ancestor and then run it forward and try to eliminate suspects.
You know what else they had to do?
What's that?
They had to think outside the box.
That's true.
That is not your normal police work that went on there. That's some... outside the box type thinking. I bet Elon Musk would like to hire those people because he's an outside of the box kind of guy.
You know, you can buy a flamethrower from him. Actually, it's not a flamethrower,
but it throws flames.
Yeah, I'm thinking about building my own prototype of it. I got an idea.
Well, you used to have a potato gun.
Yeah, this is kind of pedestrian. I want a flamethrower now.
Pedestrian? It shot the potato the length of a football field.
That's true.
That's not pedestrian if you're standing at the other end. If you're standing at the other goal line, you're in trouble. Like the javelin catcher in the Olympics.
Your job's going to be a tater catcher.
Tater taster.
Tater taster. So this whole thought process has kind of led some other ideas. Is like possibly, could you try to catch the Zodiac Killer this way? The more famous serial killer that basically was preying on people in California a little bit before this.
I think he's got to be dead by now.
Probably, because this was about 10 years before this guy, and this guy's old as Methuselah.
Yeah.
So.
Well, he's not that much older than me, so let's not put him up there by Methuselah.
I don't know.
He's 72 or 73, this guy they just caught.
Yeah, how old are you?
A gentleman never tells. I'll be 60 at the end of this month.
Well, you always seem young to me, Tommy.
Well, thanks, Mike. I appreciate that. You always seem like my little buddy.
Well, thanks, Tommy. So one of the biggest hurdles to try to catch the Zodiac Killer would actually be a clean genetic sample. And this is kind of what we mentioned a little bit before this, is because evidence collection rules were way looser back then, and crime scenes during the era when the Zodiac was there were very active because forensic science really didn't exist. This is kind of a new thing.
Yeah, so people walked around on stuff and touched stuff.
Yeah.
And everything else.
Multiple people would be there handling evidence. They wouldn't wear gloves. They, you know, maybe if they're chewing tobacco or something, spit right there in the crime scene, throw a cigarette butt down.
I always like the one where you see them pull out a pen or a pencil and pick up the gun through through the ring down there where the trigger is. And
yeah.
They pick it up and carry it that way.
It's like, we're not touching it.
Yeah.
Like I said, there was no protocol back then, and there was an example of basically a blood-soaked glove that was found from the Zodiac case, and it was just kind of laying in an evidence room, almost forgotten. And this was found in 2009, and they opened up the coroner's materials, and there was an envelope that just said, black bloody glove, and that's all it said. And the blood on the outside was identified as the Zodiac's last known victim, Paul Stein, who was a San Francisco cab driver, and he was shot in 1969. But the blood and other matter inside the glove were too muddled to use and possibly contained traces from anyone who handled it over the years. They didn't really seal it up properly. So they couldn't even use that. There was
who would have put on the glove? They said people who handled it. And if you handled it, you wouldn't have put it on your hand. So if there was DNA evidence inside the glove.
Well, maybe they did, because maybe they didn't know about DNA evidence back then. They said, you know what? Huh, this looks like a glove. I wonder if it fit my hand. Well, it fits my hand. Okay, we're looking for a killer. He's got hands the same size as me.
Hey, maybe it's me. My hand fits the glove. They can't acquit.
But you got to think about it. We've educated ourselves quite a bit in collection practices for these things.
A lot of cases in California with bloody gloves.
There are. It's a bloody glove kind of place. So there's a recreational Zodiac expert. He's got his own website, and it's Tom Voigt. He runs ZodiacKiller.com.
Is he related to John?
I don't think so. But he does drive a John Voigt mobile, I bet.
You think so?
What was that, a K-car?
On Seinfeld?
Yeah.
Yeah, John Voigt once owned it.
No, it was a...
John Voigt.
It was a LeBaron.
It was a K-car.
No, it was an old LeBaron convertible.
You know what it was?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't a fancy car at all.
I saw one of those at a car show one time, and I was freaking out. I got my picture taken with it. It was awesome.
So, I wouldn't have had my picture taken with them when they were brand new, coming off the assembly line.
Now, the one thing that this guy thought was, and he's thinking outside the box a little bit too, is like that the Zodiac Killer would send a lot of letters. He communicated with the police quite a bit, and he bets that
there's DNA on the letters.
Yeah, because he would probably lick the envelope to seal it or lick the stamp or things like that. So that's what he was thinking. He said, you just need to kind of get that kind of evidence to the lab and see what happens. So he thinks that maybe that something like this is going to make other people think about how to solve these cases outside the box a little bit, too.
Well, you know, here's the thing that strikes me the most about this, is this is kind of one of those dirty little secrets, I think, that nobody knows, is those Ancestry places, Ancestry.com or 23andMe or whatever, that your material is being put out there to the world, and it's basically a public database. When you submit it, anybody can look at it. Now, I don't think they're going through subpoenaing records or anything like that, but you could just say, hey, I'm John Doe, and I want to see if I match anybody. And you submit your sample to match other people, and there you go.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think that from what I, the research I've done on this, and basically is that they don't actually give it over easily. But if it is requested by law enforcement through a subpoena or something like that, or other, some other legal reason why that you have to turn it over, they'll turn it over.
Well, yeah, but what I'm saying is, why do you even have to have it turned over? Just submit something with the DNA and see where it goes.
Well, that's true. That's to that other, like that other database, which is different. They're not, they don't actually collect your specimen and do it.
Right.
So we're talking about like concerns, because I guess there's probably two different kinds of DNA type people out there. There's the testing sites like 23andMe, Ancestry.com, things like that. They'll actually test your DNA for you and give you some sort of code. And then there was this other website that I mentioned, GED Match, which basically analyzes DNA which has been submitted and then traces that and then puts it in that database. So there's different ways. Now, I guarantee, though, that 23andMe, Ancestry.com, I mean, obviously they have databases too, and they could probably link it up much more. And they probably do. We just don't really know about that just yet.
Yeah, they don't really want to tell you. And who knows, they might be pulling a Zuckerberg and selling the data to different law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, and basically your DNA is probably the most valuable thing you own at this point. It's what makes you you. So they say that basically they will not sell it and they won't release it to anybody. But, I mean, their contract is 20 pages long. That's from 23andMe. And I started to read through it, but then I realized that I'm really not going to read through this 20-page contract unless somebody pays me to do it. So let's just say it was long enough that I wasn't just going to just read through it. But
well, let's just say this. If they have your DNA, then there's already been a release made.
Possibly. Quite possibly. So, one funny thing I thought about when I was reading this, and it was just not think about, but I read, it was a quote, and it said, "You just wanted to find out if you're Portuguese and Spanish, but instead you found out you're related to a mass murderer."
Surprise!
Yeah, surprise.
Well, I found another one that it takes it a step further in the DNA testing, and this, once again, they have to have the catchy name, which couldn't have helped anything. This was the Phoenix Canal Killer. So, you know, there you go. But the man accused in the Phoenix Canal Killer case may have his ancestors to blame for his 2015 arrest. Records show forensic genealogy was key in leading police to Brian Patrick Miller, a man now facing a death penalty trial in the early 1990s slayings of Angela Brasso and Melanie Burness. Using a method with little precedent in the world of criminal justice, a California genealogist named Colleen Fitzpatrick handed police what would amount to a case-busting lead, the suspect's last name. "The name Miller came up in my analysis," Fitzpatrick wrote in an email that she later forwarded to investigators. Miller, a now 44-year-old father, was arrested within weeks of Fitzpatrick's emails. Police had long held samples of crime scene DNA they believed belonged to the killer, and Miller had remained in Phoenix for much of his adult life. But as investigators often bemoan, a DNA sample is useful only if you have a suspect's sample against which to compare it.
Absolutely.
So the first crime had occurred in November of 1992 when the Angela Brasso, 22-year-old, had failed to return from a bike ride, and police would soon find her headless body near 25th Avenue and Cactus Road and her head in the Arizona Canal, thus the Canal Killer moniker. Yeah. 10 months later, 17-year-old Melanie Burness would face a chillingly similar fate. In September 1993, the high school student also had been out on a bike ride before her apparent abduction. Her body was discovered the next day, also in the canal. So, apparently, I don't know, the guy didn't like people on bikes or something. But after months of speculation, police confirmed that what the community feared, that the two murders were connected by a single suspect's DNA. Over the years, officials ran DNA through databases such as CODIS, a national repository for profiles, but didn't have any hits. After Miller's January 2015 arrest, police confirmed the link was made through surreptitiously collecting Miller's DNA and matching it with that of the unknown persons. Collection methods can include picking up a suspect's used cigarette or water bottle, but police have not released details on the specific operation.
Yeah.
So they haven't said how they got his DNA.
Probably but from his trash.
Very well. Could be. But here's the link. This is what this lady, this Colleen Fitzpatrick, can do. She can take the DNA, and going through sites like Ancestry.com, she could trace it back to a family name. So that's what she went back to, the hits that it came up with, and it was a cluster of Millers.
Mm-hmm.
And it went on to describe that there was a group called Family Tree DNA, and it has the ability to test for Y-STR, which comes from the Y, or paternal chromosome. So records indicate Fitzpatrick analyzed the Y-STR for the canal killer case. The Y-STR stands for short tandem repeats, which Greenspan described as a genetic stutter. The stutters, he said, are passed on from a father to his son, literally unaltered for generations. So if they can figure out what that is, they can trace direct lineage down through father to son.
Okay.
So that's where she came up with the name Miller. So she went back to him and said, the name is Miller. That's all she gave him. Well, they went through their list of suspects, and there was a Miller on there. And it happened to be this Brian Patrick Miller that had committed these crimes. So that's what they did. They had him on the list, somehow got his DNA to look for an exact match, found that it did.
Yeah.
So they solved that much later. But, you know, so this is something that, you know, I've never heard of before. They can go back and they can identify your surname. I mean, where you came from with your surname, and they were able to take that DNA and match him into a cluster of that.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's amazing the things they're going to be able to do with DNA in the future.
They had one that happened. The police were able to detect one that was, this one, it's called the Grim Sleeper. Mm-hmm. There's another name for you.
Yeah, I read about that.
Well, this was one of the most celebrated examples of using this method. They used a familial search of prisons, and it pointed to a convict whose DNA was similar to that of a serial killer. After police created and analyzed a family tree, the prisoner's father emerged as suspect. So here was a guy in prison, and they figured out from him that his father was the one that did it. Usually you think it's the other way around.
Yeah. So they take actually genetic material or DNA samples from all felons now, I believe.
Yeah.
That's part of the deal. There was some possible law that was passed to want to take it from people who were actually arrested for felonies, but that did not quite pass muster, I believe.
You have to wait till they're convicted.
Yeah.
Because you're innocent until proven guilty, supposedly, right?
Supposedly, yes.
Yes. Now, they do want to warn, though, that you can't always trust this 100%. You have to put some common sense to it. Said, take the case, and I remember I saw this on TV and somebody did a story on it. Take the case of Michael Usry, a New Orleans filmmaker who recently became ensnared in a 1996 murder investigation of Idaho Falls teenager Angie Dodge. According to the Associated Press, Usry's father had submitted his DNA to a nonprofit organization years earlier, and that data had later been acquired by Ancestry.com. In 2014, Idaho Falls police submitted the unknown person's DNA to Ancestry.com, which produced a close match. This signaled that the killer may have been a close relative to the donor, and police acquired a search warrant for Ancestry.com to turn over the name of the donor. Usry was right age to be the killer and in turn was interrogated for hours. AP reports that Usry had last submitted a blood DNA sample and remained under suspicion until he was ruled out. Critics of the process say familial testing could have sweeping implications for privacy rights.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that, I think the term is confirmation bias too. And the problem with DNA is that you focus in on one person and then you basically use the DNA to make sure that that's who it's going
to
be.
Well, and that's what they were kind of doing to him, because I can remember, it doesn't say it in this, but I remember seeing it on the TV story. He wasn't even in the state when this happened, and they were trying to figure out a way to tie him back to it, and maybe your timeline's off, you were really there, you know, you could have done this or that. He's like, no, I wasn't there when that happened.
Yeah.
You know, but the thing was, his name was in the paper, all this other kind of stuff, as they think they found him. And so then, you know, a lot of times, even though he was cleared of it, there's a lot of people think, he was probably involved in that and got away with it. Well, not, it was just simply that his DNA was similar to whoever the person was that did it.
Yeah. So it was one of his relatives.
Well, I don't know. They never arrested anybody else. The case remains unsolved as far as I know.
Maybe he rolled over on one of his cousins. I always thought that cousin was a little weird.
Well, I would have given him up. Guy that carries around a Bowie knife and has a duffel bag filled with duct tape and rope or something like that.
Oh, you mean Cousin Stabby?
Yeah.
Cousin Stabby's all right. He would never do anything to hurt anybody.
Cousin BTK?
Yeah.
There was another one that I read about. It was a strange case of the time travel murder. And it was a real life mystery that could have come straight from the pages of a modern day detective novel. A woman had been brutally murdered in London, and biological material had been found under her fingernails, possibly indicating that she might have scratched her attacker just before she died. A sample of the material was analyzed and results compared with the National DNA database and quickly came back with a positive match. The problem was the hit identified another woman who had herself been murdered a full 3 weeks before the death of her alleged victim.
Huh.
With no sign of a connection between the two women and nothing to suggest they had ever met, the most likely scenario was that the samples had been mixed up or contaminated.
Yeah.
Well, what happened was, they go through all this, the one body that had come in 3 weeks earlier when she was murdered, they brought her, they had her kind of in the deep freeze for a while they were doing the investigation. Well, they decided they wanted fingernail samples, so they brought her out, clipped her fingernails, and put her back in the same day as this other lady arrived from her murder. Well, they went ahead kind of in the process and clipped her fingernails using the same scissors.
Yeah.
So when they tested the scissors to see, they found like 5 different DNAs on the scissors. So that's what had contaminated it. So after that, they had to change the protocol to where they use disposable scissors now. When you clip a suspect's fingernails, you have to get rid of those scissors. And what they do also, they enclose the scissors with the fingernail samples to show that the scissors have been removed from use.
Somebody posted a very interesting story on our Facebook page about some DNA samples. I don't know if you read that.
Yeah.
And it talked about how that this guy who was a kind of a known like town drunk or whatever had a pretty much a perfect alibi of not being in this home because he was in the hospital for going through detox, and there are all these medical records that showed he was there. Yet his DNA was found at the murder scene underneath the fingernails or on the fingers of the victim.
Right.
And they had a couple other suspects who they were pretty sure did it, but they couldn't really figure out how this guy was involved with them. And so they thought maybe because he kind of knew the area a little bit, he was somehow involved. Well, they eventually, and he, like I said, he had an airtight alibi pretty much that he was at the hospital at that time. So eventually the police detective figured out that when he was picked up after passing out from being drunk at the local little gas station place, the paramedics arrived on scene and they checked his pulse and took him to the hospital. 3 hours later, the same paramedics were called out to the scene where the murders were, and the paramedics actually transmitted the DNA material.
Mm.
And this article was very interesting. It went on to talk about people being shedders, that mm-hmm. they shed a lot of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
They have a lot of dead skin that falls off and things like that, and how you can really... DNA is almost always accurate, but sometimes not totally. And that gives the whole thing about, like, you can't rely on it totally and try to... You can't rely on it totally and try to...
You can't blindly
rely on it. You can't build your case around it.
You have to weigh it against everything
else. Exactly. It's a very good tool, but it's not the end-all, be-all.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great, but not perfect.
And you have to take into account also, it's like you were talking about, nobody had any protocols back in the 70s. For DNA collection and just preserving the site and stuff like that. Now they have protocols for this. And not only that, once the samples have been collected, they have chain of custodies that have to be adhered to so that you can see who had it and when and who it was turned over to. You have to sign for these things.
Yeah.
So they can trace it all the way along. If anybody had access to it, that has to be made note of the chain of custody.
Yeah, I had a case not too long ago where there was some evidence that was stored in the trunk of a police cruiser. The officer left the force and his cruiser was left unattended. And their keys were just there. So nobody knew who could have possibly gone in and out of it. So that basically ruined that chain of custody issue for it. So, but then the prosecutor disclosed that as a possible Brady violation or Brady evidence, Brady meaning like it's bad for them.
Mm-hmm.
So they're very forthright about it, but you know, it was just one of those things.
Well, that was like in the Making a Murderer. When they pulled out the vial of blood
mm-hmm.
and that they had his head in the evidence locker, and here was a hole in the top of the tube with, you know, a bloody dot around it, and because he was saying that they had samples, they could have used that and contaminated something, and, you know, to set me up.
Yeah.
And sure enough, that's sure what that looked like when they pulled that out.
It sure did.
Now, they tried to say, oh, that was when they put it in there. I don't think so. The hole was too big for that. And, you know, what happens is those rubber tops that they do that over time, those will dry out. So if you do try to put something down in there, it will, pieces of it could fall out more so than when it's still young and supple. You know, it just, the needle slides in and out easily. Yeah. But when it's older and brittle, those things break off.
That's true.
It's just like a lot of things in life.
So I'm told.
Getting old is a contact sport.
It is.
Yeah.
It's better than the alternative.
Well, that's true.
If you don't get any older, you're dead.
That's true. I was very depressed to hear a report that came out.
What's that?
For every pint of beer you drink, you lose 15 minutes off your life. So I did some quick math, and I've been dead for 3.5 years.
I'm going to miss you. As soon as we get done recording this, I'm going to lose about 45 minutes of my life.
Uh-oh. Now, sometimes people get caught by their DNA, and it's really out of their own stupidity.
Yeah.
I mean,
there are stupid criminals out there.
Because we live in a horrible world, things like rape, murder can sometimes go unpunished. So the only thing that really makes us feel better is when the perpetrator is caught in the most fittingly stupid and embarrassing way possible. Take this case from Holland, where a cold case from 1999 was solved in 2012 in a manner that shouldn't have gotten past the casual suggestion phase. They just asked politely for people to submit DNA samples, hoping to randomly find the murderer. After 13 years of dead ends, the police had no other option than to quit investigating and move on to more pressing issues. That is, until someone got this outside-the-box and quite frankly stupid idea. They would ask every male citizen living within a 5-mile radius of the crime scene to submit a DNA sample. They didn't force them or anything, just politely asked. But why in the hell would the killer submit one at all? The results of this desperate attempt were overwhelming. The gruesome crime still fresh on their minds, almost 6,600 dudes submitted their DNA to help out in the case. And one of those 6,600 dudes remembered the crime rather better than the others because he was the guy that did it. He did this voluntarily despite the fact that he must have known the police had DNA traces of the killer because he was the one who left them. It ended up being a 100% match, and so the guy did go in and voluntarily do it. And said the only thing they wondered is, why didn't he just come in and confess?
Yeah, right? It'd been easier.
Yeah.
Or maybe he was just so conceited he thought he didn't leave anything behind.
Well, it's possible, although I don't know, they're saying, I think they said it was a rape and a murder. Usually if there's a rape involved,
yeah,
they're going to leave some kind of DNA behind.
It's like everybody at the office is going to do it. It's like, hey, we're going to go down and give our DNA sample. Let's all go. Oh, no, I'd really rather not. Well, why is that? Well, no, I just don't want to. Well,
I heard a guy got convicted once for doing that.
Yeah.
It's an invasion of privacy.
And he got peer pressured into doing it.
My lawyer's Mike Meadows, and he said, don't submit to anything and don't sign nothing without reading it.
That's right.
But, well, you know, if it is a small town and most everybody knows everybody, then it is possible that it was like everybody asking, have you done it? Have you done it? Have you done it? To you know, all of them clear themselves. And it is possible, I guess, that peer pressure could have played some part in it.
Yeah.
He didn't want to have to explain why he didn't do it. That'd be embarrassing. But I think it's better to be embarrassed than...
Or maybe somebody suspected him. They said, here's his snotty rag.
But he volunteered his sample. Then asked some questions, I think, about what they knew.
Well, I think that's going to bring us to... Legal Briefs is a part of the show where we go over different legal terms and theories we talked about. Usually it's me asking Tommy if he remembers what we talked about. But before we get started on Legal Briefs, I just got a notification that Joanna Stevens asked to join the court-appointed Facebook page.
Well, permission granted.
Yeah, let's go ahead and swipe right on that. I think that's the right way to do it.
Oh, I think you just made a date with her.
Uh-oh. Anyway.
Well, congratulations. Hope you all have fun.
Back on to Legal Briefs. So, I mentioned that the oldest police trick was picking up somebody's trash. They had that guy, the Golden State Killer, under surveillance, and they found his trash. Now, what is kind of the legal theory behind that? Do you remember we talked about it before?
Well, it's that once you put your trash out at the curb, it becomes public property at that point. So it doesn't, you don't need to have a search warrant.
Well, kind of. You're skirting the edges there.
Skirting the edges?
It does not.
At least I'm not edging the skirts.
It does not violate the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits illegal search and seizure, in part because you have no expectation of privacy once you put it out there.
That's right. So, once you put it out there, don't expect it to be private.
Yeah.
That applies to a lot of things, too.
Yeah, once you put the release, it's gone.
That's right. It's like my old basketball coach told me in high school. I don't want any of you boys going out there sowing your wild oats and just praying for crop failure.
That's legitimate good advice. Now, I had mentioned before that a contract could be unconscionable.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't mention in this episode. I mentioned on a previous one.
I'll say I was searching the data banks and couldn't find that one.
Do you know what unconscionability means?
Well, that means it's not fair. It's not right. You can't do it. You're asking somebody to do something they shouldn't do or break the law or something like that.
And how does that pertain to contract law? Do you remember?
It makes the contract null and void.
Well, not necessarily makes it null and void.
You have grounds to get out of it.
Exactly. Though. It's whenever terms are so extremely or unjust that it's overwhelmingly one-sided for the party who has superior bargaining power. And it would be contrary to good conscience to allow somebody to go through with
that.
That's
what I think my billboard contract is.
You're probably right.
And I can't get anybody to handle that. Do you know a good lawyer?
I don't.
I know.
I tried to turn it over to a billboard lawyer.
I know. And a billboard lawyer wouldn't take it.
Well, I think he'll take it. He's just kind of slow.
I need a jailhouse lawyer if I can't get a billboard lawyer.
Well, there's plenty of jailhouse lawyers out there. Now, these Ancestry websites and genetic testing websites, 23andMe and whatnot, now they have standard form contracts, and those are sometimes called contracts of adhesion.
I remember that.
Do you remember what that means?
Yeah, that means pretty much take it or leave it. That they put down the terms and you got to agree to it, and you don't have any choice or just walk away.
That's right. It's a boilerplate contract, like you said, take it or leave it. Also, another term is called a leonine contract. I don't know why.
A leonine?
Yeah, it's in my notes.
Does that have anything to do with Leonardo DiCaprio?
Possibly. And basically, the terms of the contract are set by one of the parties, and like you said, it's a take it or leave it. And like I said previously, they're not against the law automatically, but there's a possibility that they would be found to be unconscionable, that previous legal term we discussed. And also, here's the interesting thing, and this is kind of an old maxim of contract law, which I don't think we talked about before, is that if there is some sort of ambiguity in the contract, the ambiguity is resolved contra pro ferentum against the party who drafted the contract. So basically, if you draft this horribly one-sided contract and it's still vague, that ambiguity is construed against you because you're the one who drafted it.
So whatever left open to interpretation, it will interpret in the favor of the other person.
Exactly. So it goes against the offer. That's like the...
So let the drafter beware.
He who smelt it, dealt it.
Oh, yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, that's probably right.
So, now, I got one other good question for you. Uh-oh. Knowing what we just talked about with the DNA and the fact that you're releasing your DNA,
I didn't talk about releasing my DNA.
Why would anybody submit their DNA to one of these testing websites?
Because you're curious. You want to know where your ancestors are and everything.
That's true. But there's another good reason, too.
They can find diseases, certain things that you might test for they can find early advanced signs of people that might have certain forms of cancer and stuff like that.
Yeah. There's one more good reason, too.
Because you're proving yourself innocent.
Could be. There's one more good reason, too.
You have fun releasing your DNA.
True. But there could be one more reason.
I'm running out of reasons.
I have what I'm looking for. I'll tell you what it is. One of those websites might sponsor our podcast.
Oh.
Then you should definitely do it.
Yeah, that's right. But I'll tell you the truth. I think that everybody should be in a database anyway. I think they should submit everybody's.
Here we go.
Everybody's DNA should be on file. You should have nothing to hide. It would cut down on crime. If you knew you were going to get caught if you did something, don't you think you wouldn't do it? I mean, unless you were drunk.
No, I'm sorry. I disagree with you, Comrade Smurl. I live in America.
I don't care. I want everybody to submit your DNA at once, and we're going to compile it all in one big database, and then no one has anything to hide. So there, we'll just go forward from that. And if you don't submit to that, then we're going to chip you.
You want everyone to release their DNA all at once?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Not in the same place, though. We might be in a flood zone.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well then, not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.
Thanks for listening.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.